The following podcast is provided to you free, as is all our content, at drhoffman.com. If you'd like to listen, help support Intelligent Medicine, and get great values by shopping at our supplement store, go to drhoffman.com and click on Shop, then click on the store. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and it's time for our weekly clinical focus. We go through various medical syndromes and nutritional issues, and we've covered several in the past few weeks, and we'll continue to work our way through the annals of medicine and nutrition, with today's focus being a condition called Barrett's esophagus. Barrett's esophagus is a condition that's gotten a lot of ballyhoo lately. It's something that doctors are alerting patients to, and it's creating a good deal of consternation. It's resulting in patients getting a lot of tests, and it's resulting in patients getting a lot of medication, and of course it results in a certain amount of apprehension. So what is Barrett's esophagus, first of all? Well, Barrett's esophagus is thought to be a precancer of the esophagus. And it's kind of along the lines of doing pap smears. We do pap smears now because the occasional woman who has an abnormal pap smear, that's sometimes an accurate predictor of who is going to go on to get cervical cancer. And pap smears are an example of screening tests that actually help to save lives. Women who get regular pap smears, who are at risk, then can get treatment to reduce their chance of developing cervical cancer. Well, similarly, the esophagus is also a mucous membrane. It's at the other side of the body. It can show precancerous changes, which can be a harbinger of cancer. And esophageal cancer is a terrible problem because it is very, very hard to treat and cure. The 5-year survival rate for esophageal cancer is less than 10%. 90% of patients are dead within 5 years, and some of them die within a short period of time, within 6 months. It's a very deadly form of cancer once it develops. So certainly the idea of preventing esophageal cancer, a very appealing idea. How common is esophageal cancer? Well, it's actually not very common. 6,000 people a year die of esophageal cancer. So compare that to the rate of colon cancer. That's the second most common cancer in America. And colon cancer claims 60,000 lives annually. So your chances of getting esophageal cancer are very low. But were you to get it, it's a very bad thing. So happened is, and I think that this is an example of something. It's sort of the law of good intentions and with unintended consequences. We suddenly developed a technology and a medical pharmacopoeia that could address this problem. The first step in the technology was to develop fiber optic scopes that we could use to look down people's throats into their esophagus and stomach. And this is actually quite an advance. It developed approximately 3 or 4 decades ago. I remember even during my medical school training, we didn't have fiber optic scopes. We had rigid scopes, which were a little bit like sword swallowing. You had to anesthetize the patient big time, and then you would stick a straight tube down their throat. And it's very, very hard to perform that test. You wouldn't do it casually as a matter of screening. But screening is easier now with the fiber optic scopes. And so it's not uncommon for patients who have reflux or discomfort. We go down there and we look and we see what's going on. And in addition, that wasn't necessary and sufficient. It was necessary, but not sufficient to develop this concept of Barrett's esophagus and screening for esophageal precancer and the notion of prevention. Another essential ingredient was the advent of very, very powerful acid-blocking medications that could completely knock out stomach acid. And the idea being that if you spotted an early precancer, the thought was that it was caused by acid and you completely turn off the acidity, and thereby you would come up with an effective preventive strategy for reducing the death rate from esophageal cancer. And it's a little bit like what Eisenhower predicted when he left. It was one of his final speeches, was a speech about the military-industrial complex. He said he warned America to be wary of the military-industrial complex. We can sort of paraphrase Eisenhower by saying, be wary of the pharmaceutical medical complex, because we tend to invent new disease categories, and we then rationalize very aggressive treatment on the basis of new technologies and new concepts. I mean, nobody knew from Barrett's esophagus it would be like some unfortunates would develop esophageal cancer. There wasn't much we could do for them. But then we developed the notion of Barrett's esophagus, which rationalized both a lot of screening endoscopies, which could be profitable for the instrument makers. These devices are very, very expensive. Gastroenterologists now have something else to scope. Sometimes this is referred to disparagingly as scoping for dollars. It is a source of income for gastroenterologists. I don't mean to impugn gastroenterologists, because they're out there to save lives and they believe in it. And certainly with colonoscopy and endoscopy, they are saving lives. But the question becomes, how zealous should we be about screening people for esophageal precancer? And then, of course, there's the pharmaceutical industry, and I believe now the number one drug category in America, the number one drug category in America is statin drugs, no question, hands down, and worldwide, statin drugs are number one. But number two, the acid-blocking medications. And the acid-blocking medications have negative consequences. They increase the risk of problems in the gastrointestinal tract. It may quell the acidity in the upper tract, but it may increase the risk of irritable bowel. May increase the risk of gastrointestinal infection, particularly C. difficile infection, pneumonia. There are a host of problems associated and side effects associated with chronic use of these medications, osteoporosis, magnesium deficiency, B12 deficiency, and on and on. So is this justified? How far should we go to screen for esophageal cancer? Well, okay, in the first part, we're going to divide this podcast into two parts. We're well launched into part one, where I define the problem, and I'm going to talk a little bit about testing and the pro and con about testing and some new alternatives to testing and about the conventional treatment strategies. In part two, we're going to go to natural approaches for treating not esophageal cancer, but Barrett's esophagus. I think that's our best chance at heading off what will become a very serious, dangerous, and hard-to-treat cancer. I think prevention is really the key. So, first of all, I would pose the question to you who are listening. If you were to have Barrett's esophagus, by the way, the estimates are that when people have reflux or GERD and they look down there, approximately 5 to 10% of people have Barrett's esophagus. These are abnormal cells that resemble the beginning of cellular abnormalities and pap smears that might eventually lead to cancer. So the question is for you out there, some of you who may be suffering from Barrett's esophagus and listening attentively to this, I ask this question all the time in my office of patients who've been diagnosed with Barrett's esophagus and come to see me for nutritional support. I ask, what do you think the chances are that you will develop esophageal cancer based on your diagnosis of Barrett's esophagus? All right? So write your answer down and then listen up. Okay? You all have it written down? All right. Well, many people answer with outlandish answers. They sometimes say 50%. And of course, that's not true, because there's so many people who have Barrett's esophagus, you know, tens and tens and tens of thousands, perhaps even in the hundreds of thousands. And, you know, the statistics show that only 6,000 people die of esophageal cancer each year. And so clearly it's less than 50%. So a lot of people answer 20%, 10%. 5% would be a more reasonable answer. That's where I get a lot of answers. So 5% is a common answer. So you want to know what the real frequency of Barrett's esophagus is. This is from an article in the New York Times, October 13, 2011, by Anahad O'Connor, science correspondent there. Headline, cancer risk from Barrett's esophagus lower than thought. She writes, people who have a condition known as Barrett's esophagus, a complication of acid reflux disease, have a higher risk of developing esophageal cancer. That we know. But the risk is far smaller than widely believed. She writes that, by the way, she gives a statistic that Barrett's esophagus affects about 1 million Americans. So you may say, well, you know, why am I doing a podcast on such an obscure problem? No, it's 1 in 200 among Americans. And they've long been encouraged to undergo repeated invasive screening tests to look for signs of cancer in their esophagus. The condition was thought to make cancer of the esophagus up to 40 times as likely. Now, that's scary, right? I mean, if there was an airline that had 40 times as many plane crashes, would you get on that airline? No way. But, she writes, the new study found that the risk of esophageal cancer in Barrett's patients was only about a fifth of what is currently believed. And that suggests that the routine tests and endoscopies patients are subjected to may not be necessary in many cases. And this is based on an article in the New England Journal of Medicine that appeared in 2011. So, what was ultimately the risk of esophageal cancer in a patient with Barrett's? The study found that every year, 0.12% of the Barrett's patients, or about 1 in 860, go on to develop cancer of the esophagus. The figure, she says, was much lower than the estimated 0.5% stemming from earlier studies. That would be 1 in 200. Instead of 1 in 200, it's 1 in 860. And in another study that was published in Journal of the National Cancer Institute, comparable study, that study found the risk of esophageal cancer in people with Barrett's was similar, 0.13%. And so this is a bit of a problem because they have now done what are called cost-benefit analysis on all the money that is now expended. So remember, there's 1 million people who have Barrett's esophagus in this country alone. And if that 1 million people, they suggest surveillance for these people and that these people be on acid-blocking medications for a lifetime. And so let's, you know, 1 million people times, whatever, $1,200, $1,600 bucks for an endoscopy. I don't know what doctors get these days, but it's expensive. Do it year in and year out. Is it cost-effective? Well, anything to save even one life is cost-effective, right? So they're not going to deny endoscopy to people who might potentially die. And so the question has arisen, and it's now being debated publicly. Is this a good idea to bring people in, year out for endoscopy, which is unpleasant? Sometimes there are side effects, and it's expensive and rarely yields any additional information. I mean, if you've got, what are you going to do differently? I mean, I guess there is the potential for doing esophageal surgery. There's also laser and radio frequency ablation to burn out the abnormal areas. That is now a popular procedure, and it seems to reduce the risk of death. But what are you going to do? This is a public health dilemma. The question has arisen, how far should we screen? Well, there's actually some evidence that we can determine who's at higher risk. So smokers are at much higher risk. People who have continued reflux in spite of treatment with acid blockers are at higher risk. People who happen to be male are at higher risk. 90% of esophageal cancer is male. And that is of interest. Also, the incidence in Caucasians is 2 to 4 times higher than in non-Caucasians. And in overweight individuals, there's also a higher risk. So you can also look at the initial results of an endoscopy and if there's such a thing as low-grade changes and high-grade changes that are more alarming and suggest a need for more frequent screening. In patients with high-grade changes, the risk of cancer may be as high as 6%. So that's about the screening. Of interest is that they're coming up with new ways to screen for this disease. Just as we're now coming up with, in a previous podcast, I'd like you to check it out, on colon cancer, we're coming up with ways that we can examine stool for tiny, tiny fragments of DNA associated with cancer, very sensitive testing. We're now coming up with an interesting test for esophageal cancer. It's a string test. You swallow like a tiny sponge on a string, and it brushes against your esophagus. It's then pulled out, and it is coated with cells from your esophagus, and very tiny traces of cancerous or precancerous cells can indicate a need for further examination and treatment. That is something that may be coming down the pike as a future treatment for esophageal cancer. It's a very interesting prospect. Will hopefully reduce costs, but may put some gastroenterologists out of business, in effect. So let's look at, before we get to part two, where we're going to talk about specific supplements that are protective, because I really welcome patients who have Barrett's esophagus. First of all, the first thing I do is I reassure them with the previous discussion that we had. Many of them are just petrified that they're going to develop esophageal cancer. Their chances of developing esophageal cancer are actually relatively low, and especially if they do some of the right things. So what are the risk factors? Well, certainly smoking is a big risk factor. So it's absolutely essential that someone with esophageal changes stop smoking. That's absolutely essential. Also, weight loss seems to be helpful because you put less pressure on your esophageal sphincter, where you can reflux up. Also, excess weight may be a risk factor for many cancers in general because of what it does to your metabolism and immune system. Certain types of diets may predispose to this. In Japan and in China, where they consume an awful lot of pickles that are preserved with poor quality preservatives and chemicals, there's a very high incidence of esophageal cancer. What has been shown is that, and we'll talk about this in part two, is that if you drink green tea, that you can actually mitigate that risk in Asians. That's how green tea was discovered as an anti-cancer agent. Individuals who drank 6 or 8 cups of green tea a day, that's fairly common in Asia, not so much in the United States. We prefer coffee or black tea, but a green tea confers protection upon the esophagus and can help regulate the proliferation of cells. The dietary factors, fried food, charred meat, meat that's treated with nitrites may actually contribute to the risk. This would be processed meats, bacon, and so on. Although it's not clear whether abstaining from meat is the answer for esophageal cancer invariably. Lots and lots of fresh fruits and vegetables providing beneficial plant polyphenols seems to be helpful for preventing esophageal cancer. That's an important element of the diet. And when it comes to treatment, what about acid-blocking medication? Well, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal that came out a few years back suggesting that it wasn't a simple matter of giving everyone with Barrett's esophagus acid-blocking medication. That's the standard of treatment. However, they noted that since the adoption of that form of therapy for literally 1 million Americans who have this condition, the rate of esophageal cancer has not declined. It's actually gone up. So that suggests that there's something missing from our approach to esophageal cancer, that stopping acidity is not just what's necessary. However, there are studies that suggest that all patients with Barrett's esophagus should be treated with proton pump inhibitors, i.e. Nexium, and, you know, these types of medications, Prilosec, and so on, because there's a 37% risk reduction for developing dysplasia. That's a more advanced form of Barrett's, based on a 20-year prospective cohort. So that part of the therapeutic approach using acid-blocking medication is probably warranted. I have some patients who, after a series of normal endoscopies where the condition has been reversed and has disappeared, they've gone off their acid blockers with my approval. But I got to say that the standard of care, if you have Barrett's, is that you go permanently on an acid blocking medication. Standard of care means if your doctor doesn't encourage you to do that, that doctor could be sued if you were to go on to develop cancer. And I think no doctor wants to be in that position. It's, you know, standard of care sometimes dictates treatment. It's very hard to step away from that. So I urge my patients to comply with their gastroenterologist's recommendations that they take strong acid-blocking medication. It may help, but that in itself is not enough to completely eliminate the risk of esophageal cancer, because if it were, then nobody would develop esophageal cancer. Virtually all patients now who have GERD are getting screened, and then they find Barrett's, and then they're put on acid-blocking medication. Still, the statistics don't budge, and in fact, the rate of esophageal cancer is somewhat going up. So the acid-blocking blockers are not enough. And in part two of this podcast coming up, we're going to talk about some nutritional and supplement strategies for preventing esophageal cancer if you have Barrett's, and even completely reversing and eradicating Barrett's, because abnormal cells can revert to normal given the right type of therapy. So stay tuned for part two, and we'll discuss specific natural treatment for Barrett's esophagus. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.